Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Happy Independence Day to you. Happy 4th of July. If you're not in the United States, we celebrate on the 4th of July because it's the day that we declared our independence from...
We threw off the shackles of our British overlords.
And that's why if
no,
you're...
No offense to our former British overlords.
No, as a matter of fact, if you're in Great Britain, you go to the top of the line today. Your call goes to the top of the line because we'd like to wish you... That's just so
celebrate
mean.
Celebrate with us.
That's all mean. But that is exactly what happened. And it seems to me that it all worked out. So I don't know. But if you have hard feelings about it, I'm really sorry about your feelings. Is that how you do that? I'm not sorry about the independence, but I'm sorry about your feelings. But hey, 4th of July here in the United States, by the way, that was Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's going to be Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin, but an internet variety. We've got a whole lot of questions from the internet for Jimmy. So first of all, let me welcome you, Jimmy. Happy 4th to you.
Happy 4th of July to you, Cy Kellett.
That's a very early salutation because, of course, we are pre-recording this because we'll be doing...
Why not?
Why not? We'll be doing 4th of July stuff on the 4th of July. And that brings me to a set of questions I have for you, Jimmy, because you are known for solving mysteries. So I assembled 5 mysteries of the 4th of July. And I want to. And in my research, I did actual research for this to come up with mysteries for the 4th of July. I think I was vaguely aware of this, but I did not realize quite how powerful the debate is about whether a hot dog is a sandwich. Now, that's not one of the mysteries, but this is just a fact that I ran into. So I'm just springing this on you. Do you have an opinion about it? It's not a mystery. It's an opinion thing. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
I think it depends on how you define sandwich. Yeah. It's kind of an open-faced sandwich with the bun serving as a single piece of bread, but it's going to depend on whether you're using a definition that specifies particular elements or whether you're using a prototype definition where some objects resemble a prototype example more than others, whereas they may have the same elements. So, for example, penguins are birds based on their, anatomical classification. But people, if you say, imagine a bird, most people are not going to think of a penguin. They're going to think of like a robin or a starling or something like that, which are more prototypical of what people consider birds to be. So if you define a hot dog by its parts, it's an open-faced sandwich. So is a pizza.
But I didn't think about that.
But if you define it based on its prototype, the prototype of what we imagine a sandwich to be, you could say it's not.
That's an excellent point. But the thing is, if someone said to me, I'm going to have a hot dog sandwich, I would assume they're getting 2 pieces of bread and they're chopping that hot dog up and making a sandwich out of it. It doesn't immediately strike. Well, anyway, that's my. All right. Here's 5 mysteries. So mystery one, because you are the mystery man, you solve mysteries for people. So here's my first mystery of the 4th of July. What's in a hot dog?
Well, it depends on the hot dog. They are made quite differently. Some of them are made of beef. Some of them are made of pork. Some of them are made of chicken. Some of them are made of turkey. Some of them are made of a combination of those meats. Because hot dogs are a ground sausage product, that means you don't have to focus on the more choice cuts of these animals. You can use, scrap meat, and it's all going to get ground up anyway. I have seen various forms of pork products, if you're, at least I've seen them here in Arkansas. I don't know if you see them in California so much, you can tell me. But there are various pork products that will be labeled whole hog. And that's where they take basically the entire hog and grind it up.
Oh.
In addition to the meat that's in a hot dog, they also include various spices like salt and various, you know, other kinds of spices. They include preservatives to make the meat last longer on the shelf. They may include things like water and corn syrup and modified food starch. Then there are veggie dogs, which are made out of veggies.
I'm just so glad the answer was not Jimmy Hoffa. All right, that's mystery number one. We all love the fireworks of the 4th of July. Who invented fireworks, Jimmy?
Well, I hate to burst your bubble if you were hoping me to mention an American, but fireworks have been around for centuries longer than America has. And actually, they were first, so far as we know, invented in China. As early as the 2nd century BC, Chinese individuals were making firecrackers. And, you know, they had invented gunpowder. They didn't use it for guns, but they had invented gunpowder, and they used it for things like firecrackers, and then they got more pyrotechnic effects, and so it kind of grew from there.
Did you say BC?
Yeah, 2nd century BC.
Wow. Wow. They are, China, you are ahead of your time. All right. How does sunscreen work? That's mystery number three of the 4th of July. How does it work?
Okay, there are two types of sunscreen. One kind blocks the ultraviolet radiation coming from our star, the sun. And these sun blocks use minerals like zinc oxide and titanium oxide to block the ultraviolet radiation. So that's one type of sunscreen. The other type of sunscreen doesn't block the rays, but it absorbs and the rays and converts them into heat, which is then dissipated from the skin. And substances that do this include these absorbers, include things like avobenzone and oxybenzone.
Which one's better? I don't know which one. I feel like if I put on the zinc one, I'm now reflecting the rays onto the person next to me, and I'm making the situation worse for them. I'm creating a worse sunburn for the person next to me.
I would suspect that that the direct rays they're getting from the sun are going to be much more potent than anything reflecting off of your zinc oxide.
All right, two major ones. And I will say number five is the I think it's the predominant mystery of the 4th of July. And we're going to get to that momentarily. But Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is the podcast. Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin is something we do all the time. Jimmy Akin is the mystery solver. So I've got mysteries of the 4th of July for Jimmy. Bald eagles, Jimmy. Are they really bald?
No, bald eagles are not bald. Their head is covered with feathers, just like the rest of their body, but they have a distinctive marking where they will have white feathers on their heads compared to brown feathers on the rest of their bodies. And consequently, they're not really bald at all. If we were naming them more literally, we might call them white-headed eagles rather than bald eagles. Uh-huh. But they are not bald. It's just they kind of maybe sort of kind of ish look bald, given that we think of most eagles being brown, and these guys have this white patch on their head. So they, I guess, figuratively look bald, but they're actually not bald at all.
I'm glad to hear that, because there are some birds that are bald. There are birds that don't have feathers on their head, and they're weird looking. No offense, birds. No, I'm so sorry, California condor. I didn't mean to make you feel bad. Jimmy, this is the greatest mystery of the 4th of July. It's entirely unsolved. So if you solve this, then we will change the whole history and trajectory of the country. The Continental Congress was actually not a Continental Congress. It was a Continental Congref. Why?
No.
Why did they use the letter F when they clearly needed to use the letter S?
Okay, so they're not actually using the letter F. English, like a few other languages, including Greek, has more than one typographical form or handwritten form for the letter S. You see this in Greek all the time. There's a difference between the sigmas that you see on the front of a word or in the middle of a word and the sigma that you'll see on the end of the word, which is known as the final sigma. It's all the letter S, but it's written a different way. And the same thing is true of the letter S in German, at least historically, and also in English historically. So if you think about that weird letter that looks like an F, but it's where you'd expect an S, that's what's known as a long S. Oh. It's like you take the letter S and you stretch it out vertically. And so it is the letter S. It's just stretched out in such a way that it looks like the letter F. And the long S was used in handwriting and in typography between the 8th and the 19th century. But in the 18th and 19th centuries, people would start confusing it with the letter F, and so it gradually fell out. Originally, it was used in specific positions in the word, just like in Greek. The long S was used, for example, in the middle of a word or at the beginning of a word. And the short S that we're familiar with now was used at the end of a word, just like final sigma was in Greek.
Thank you, Jimmy, for solving my great mysteries of the 4th of July. Happy 4th of July to everybody listening. We're going to take a very quick break, and we will come back with lots of questions for Jimmy that have come in from the internet. It is a holiday, and I want to especially welcome those who, because you're working at this time, or maybe you're in a different geographic location, this is the first time you're catching us. Catholic Answers Live is it is exactly what it says it is. We just answer questions about the Catholic faith. And if you want to find out about us, you can go to our website, catholic.com, catholic.com. And we're glad you're here. Thanks for listening. Right back with more Ask Me Anything, Internet Variety with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you looking to study Catholic theology in a formal way with the guidance of faithful scholars? Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by the Augustine Institute, offering master's degrees in theology, pastoral theology, and Catholic education with flexible study options on campus, online, or both. The Augustine Institute equips students to serve Christ and His church in schools, parishes, dioceses, apostolates, and the home. Learn more today at augustine.edu.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 2011. EWTN acquires the National Catholic Register, the nation's leading Catholic newspaper. The latest in the network's efforts to expand its news presence in the global Catholic digital and multimedia market.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, and happy Independence Day to you. Jimmy Akin is our guest both hours. It's an internet show. All the questions have come already to us from the internet, and we've gathered them up here, and we're going to ask Jimmy Akin those questions. And I'll start with Malulani, 056, who wants to know, why do you hate the traditional Latin Mass?
I don't hate the traditional Latin Mass. I support the traditional Latin Mass. I cheered when Benedict XVI liberalized its celebration. I was very disappointed when Pope Francis restricted it further. I'm glad it's still available to people. And I hope that Pope Leo re-liberalizes its celebration. So I don't know who you've been listening to. I know there are people out there who seem to enjoy deliberately misrepresenting what I think and try to portray me as if I'm not a friend of tradition, when in fact I am. So I figured this would be a good question to just clear the air a little bit. I don't oppose the traditional at mass at all. I think it's part of the wonderful diversity of different liturgical celebrations that Christ has put in his church. You know, we have all the different Eastern rites, we have variations on the Latin rite, and I'm in favor of them all. I think they're all wonderful and they all glorify God.
Malu, thank you very much for the question. This next one comes from Michael. Okay, this let me get this correct. Did Christ always have a human nature, or did God change and gain a human nature at the moment of the incarnation? What is the best language to describe this mystery?
Okay, so one of the things that the church teaches about the divine nature is it exists outside of time, and therefore it cannot change. It is immutable, to use a Latin-based word for it. So since Christ, the Son of God, became incarnate in time, and time is where change occurs, any time that we speak of must, any change that occurs, we must speak of as occurring in time, not in eternity, which is outside of time. So the Son of God spans both eternity, which is outside of the flow of time, and time itself. So you got to pick your frame of reference, as Herr Dr. Einstein taught us. If you pick eternity as your frame of reference, then God does not change. And so from the eternal perspective, the Son of God has, quote unquote, always had, this is an eternal always, has always had a human nature. That human nature begins at a certain moment in time, let's say 2 or 3 BC, and then continues forward from there. But from the static eternal now outside of time, he's always had this nature, and it begins at a certain moment in time. If you flip that around and look at the situation, if you pick time as your frame of reference, then if you ask in, let's say, 10 BC, does the Son of God have a human nature now, meaning now in 10 BC, the answer is no. And that will continue to be the answer until you get up to 2 or 3 BC, when the answer is going to change to yes. So from a perspective inside of time, there is a change that occurs, whereas where the Son of God does not have a human nature before a certain point and does have a human nature after that point. But from eternity as your frame of reference, he just always has a human nature that begins in 3 or 2 BC and continues thereafter.
Oh, wow. Michael, thank you very much for the question. The next question comes from, It comes from Duff Beer. Duff Beer asks, if we interpret Genesis as describing God's creation of man through evolution, and the flood as describing a population bottleneck thousands or hundreds of thousands of years before Genesis was recorded, is it possible that the author incorporated contemporary myths into the writing of Genesis? There are Mesopotamian flood myths that predate the writing of Genesis by at least 100 years, likely inspired by the flooding of the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. If God revealed to me the knowledge of a battle between good and evil, I might visualize it as an Avengers-style fight or a Lord of the Rings-style battle because of my contemporary culture. Would it be acceptable to think the writer of Genesis did the same thing, using a popular myth that already existed when Genesis was being recorded, to convey why God destroyed the wicked and created the covenant, even if the means God used were different in prehistory?
Okay, so I want to make sure we're clear on what Duffbier is proposing here. He's assuming that we're interpreting Genesis as describing a population bottleneck that occurred thousands or hundreds of thousands of years before Genesis. And what he's asking is, if that's what Genesis is talking about, could the author of Genesis have described that population bottleneck? In a population bottleneck is when a large part of a population dies off. So it's like all the genetic material that survives has to go through this smaller number of people, which is why it's called a bottleneck. He's asking, could an earlier population bottleneck have been described in terms of stories that were told in Mesopotamia that were likely based on the flooding of the Tigris and the Euphrates, which is a well-known phenomenon that happens over there? Well, personally, I don't think that Genesis should be interpreted in terms of a population bottleneck that occurred hundreds of thousands of years earlier. I don't think that there is any plausible mechanism for the societies to have transmitted information about such a population bottleneck up to the time Genesis was written, about 1000 BC. I think whatever Genesis is describing, it's much more recent than that. But we can go with Duffbier's framing of the issue. So if Genesis is describing a much earlier population bottleneck, could the author of Genesis have taken more recent events or stories and used them to depict that population bottleneck the same way that he says he might envision a fight between good and evil as something you'd see in the Avengers or a Lord of the Rings movie? Well, we actually have a discussion of the extent to which Genesis might incorporate prior popular stories. This comes from Pope Pius XII's encyclical Humanae Generis, which was released in 1950, 75 years ago. And things have shifted some since Humanae Generis was released 75 years ago, but the same fundamental principles are going to apply. So if you look in sections 38 and 39 of Humanae Generis, Pope Pius XII says this. He says, "The first 11 chapters of Genesis, although properly speaking not conforming to the historical method used by the best Greek and Latin writers or by competent authors of our time, do nevertheless pertain to history in a true sense, which, however, must be further studied and determined by exegetes," which is what's been happening in the last 75 years. "The same chapters in simple and metaphorical language adapted to the mentality of a people but little cultured, both state the principal truths which are fundamental for our salvation and also give a popular description of the origin of the human race and the chosen people. If, however, the ancient sacred writers have taken anything from popular narrations, and this may be conceded," Pius XII says. So he's conceding the author of Genesis may have taken material from popular narrations. "It must never be forgotten that they did so with the help of divine inspiration, through which they were rendered immune from any error in selecting and evaluating those documents. Therefore, whatever of the popular narrations have been inserted into the sacred scriptures must in no way be considered on par with the myths or other such things, which are more the product of an extravagant imagination than of that striving for the truth and simplicity, which in the sacred books, also of the Old Testament, is so apparent that our ancient sacred writers must be admitted to be clearly superior to the ancient profane writers." So he's saying that the author of Genesis, especially in the first 11 chapters, may have taken stuff from popular narrations. He doesn't call them myths, that, you know, would have a pejorative connotation that he wants to avoid, but there were narrations or stories, as I called them, about great floods. You know, in the Mesopotamian context, there's, you know, like the equivalent of Noah was a guy named Utnapishtim, And so there were stories about Utnapishtim and how he survived the Great Flood. In Greek, now this is later, but in Greek stories, there was Deucalion, who was the survivor of the Great Flood. And what Pope Pius XII is saying is that the author of Genesis may have used earlier narrations like those coming from Babylonia, but in the process of incorporating them into sacred scripture, he was protected by divine inspiration. So I would say that the answer to Duff Beer's question is yes, these texts could have been influenced by earlier stories about a great flood and how people survived it, the same way that he's proposing that you might have an earlier population bottleneck that then gets depicted in these more in terms of more recent stories. So I would say the basic answer to his question is yes, it could have happened this way, but personally, I don't think Genesis is talking about something that happened hundreds of thousands of years earlier. But if you do, you do you.
Yeah, good advice for Duff Beer. Duff Beer, thank you very much for the question. Lots more questions to come. We've got, well, the internet, because it's made by people, has endless questions. And so we will get to more of those questions with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Happy Independence Day to you. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we've got lots of internet questions for today. Jimmy, we started by asking Jimmy some of the mysterious, to solve some mysteries of the 4th of July for us. And part of why we think of Jimmy as a mystery solver is that he's got hundreds of episodes of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and a new one drops each Friday. And it being Friday, do you drop episodes on holidays as well, Jimmy?
Oh, yeah. I don't let holidays stop me.
And so what dropped today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Today's episode looks at the second most famous equation in science. Now, the most famous equation is Albert Einstein's E equals mc squared. But second to that, there's what's known as the Drake equation. And the Drake equation was produced in the 1960s by an astronomer named Frank Drake. And it deals with the how many technological civilizations may be out there in the galaxy currently that we could communicate with. And you can try to calculate this by figuring out certain factors, like how often do new stars form, how many of these stars have planets, how many of those planets are habitable, how many of the habitable planets end up developing life, how many planets with life develop intelligence, and how many planets with intelligent life develop technology that we could communicate with, and then how long do those civilizations survive? So there's a lot of interesting stuff that you could figure out if you could pin down those numbers that you need to plug into those variables. And we've learned more, quite a bit more, about some of the variables since the 1960s. So I go through the Drake equation. I talk about how it came about. I talk about what was known in the 1960s when the original estimates were done, and then what we've learned since then and what that may say about, are there people out there that we could actually communicate with?
Oh, fascinating. All right. So you're taking on the Drake equation. I would guess that if you went back to the 1960s, they would think there are fewer planets in the galaxy than we currently think. It seems to me like we've been amazed at how many planets there are.
That is one of the things that has shifted, yes. Back in the 1960s, when the Drake equation was first created, they thought most stars probably didn't have planets. And since then, we've learned, nope, there are about as many planets as there are stars. Every star seems to have at least one planet.
There's always one. There's always one planet. Let's go back to the question. Check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, though. Check it out at mysterious.fm. Check it out at Jimmy's YouTube channel, the Jimmy Akin channel on YouTube, where you can also get the Jimmy Akin podcast, where he tackles mysteries of the faith each Monday. So you get a mystery to begin and end the work week if you subscribe to the Jimmy Akin channel on YouTube. Shalone wants to know this. Why did the church go from severe fasting to weekly fasting to weekly abstinence? And now in the U.S., some other penance can substitute for abstinence. There are currently only 2 days a year of actual fasting and abstinence that are required in the U.S. Is this a good or bad progression, spiritually speaking?
Okay, so we got two questions here, but first I need to make a minor factual correction. Shalone says that now in the U.S., some other penance can substitute for abstinence, meaning on Fridays outside of Lent. During Lent, you still got to abstain on Fridays, abstain from meat. That's actually not quite accurate. If you go back, and this is something all kinds of folks get wrong, the idea that if you don't want to abstain, you got to substitute some other penance. That is not what the church's legal documents actually say. Most people never go back and look up these documents, and most of the ones who do don't read them carefully, but I have. And if you go back and look at the implementing legislation that the U.S. bishops authorized in the 1960s, they don't say that you need to substitute another penance for abstinence if you don't want to abstain from meat. What they say is, we hereby terminate the requirement to abstain from meat on Fridays outside of Lent, and we recommend that you either abstain or do something else. But they don't require that you do something else. So it's not the case that other penances can substitute for the requirement of abstinence in the United States on Fridays outside of Lent. There just is no requirement to do a specific form of penance on Fridays outside of Lent. You're advised to do so. You're encouraged to do so, but it's not required. So having said that, let's look at the first question. Why did the church go from more severe fasting to less, notably less severe fast in? Well, basically, the fundamental reason is the church adapts its practices to the conditions of the time. And so conditions have changed over the last 2,000 years, and bishops have ramped up and ramped down various practical requirements of how we practice the faith. This is one of them. Now, if you're looking for a specific circumstance that has changed in society that would lead the bishops to decrease the amount of fasting that people need to do, I don't have an official source on this, but what I would say is it was industrialization. What you find is if you look in the Middle Ages, when they had the more severe fasting requirements, it was during a period where people had a fairly relaxed approach to work by modern standards. They, in fact, you know, in some places, almost half the year would be holy days. And so they didn't have the kind of intense work schedules that we do now. But then, beginning in the 1700s, this industrialization started and we got factories and people started moving off the farm where they couldn't just take a day off. And they had to show up for work every day in the factory and work hard in those factories, you know, the dark satanic mills that they talk about in England. And you had to keep your strength up while you were working. You're using heavy factory equipment. You know, you're running bandsaws and metal presses and all kinds of things like that. You got to be careful. You got to keep your strength up. You got to keep your alertness up. And that makes it harder for a lot of folks to fast, especially people who are not used to fasting. You know, most people here in the West historically would eat three times a day. Now, because of some recent very bad health advice that some people have gotten, they encourage a grazing strategy where you're eating like six or seven little meals a day. That's terrible advice. But historically, people would eat three times a day. You'd break your fast in the morning, which is where we get the word breakfast. You'd have a meal around noon, and you'd have another meal in the evening. And if you're used to eating three times a day, then your body will adapt to eating three times a day. And if you suddenly stop, then your body says, wait a minute, something's going on here. Food's not available. We better slow down our metabolism and ramp up the hunger at the same time to encourage him to go find food. So that would cause problems for people in factories to keep up their alertness and strength. And so you started finding more and more exceptions written into the church's moral and pastoral theology handbooks and canon law books and things like that, where it would say, well, you need to fast on Friday, but if you work in a job that would be dangerous if you did that, or you need to keep your strength up, you know, then you can have some food. And more exceptions got written in. And eventually they just said, let's just diminish the requirement, because people today work job schedules where they can't just say, oh, today's a fasting day, so we're really going to kind of kick back and not spend a lot of energy. So I think that's the primary factor, industrialization, for why the requirements got less. Now, that actually wouldn't bug me, because I fast every day except Sundays and holy days of obligation. I have one meal a day. So it doesn't bug me to be fasting during the day. But if you're used to eating three times a day, it will bug you. So I think that's the basic reason. Shalone then asks, is this a good or a bad progression, spiritually speaking? And I think that that's something people can have different opinions on. there's no magic level of fasting that all Christians are obliged to observe. Fasting is meant to, and like abstinence, is meant to help us grow closer to God. And so if more fasting would help us grow closer to God, then that would be a good thing to do. If less fasting would help more people grow closer to God, then that would be a good thing to do. You know, you can imagine how in the age of industrialization, with all these folks working in factories, if they suddenly said, oh, we got to do a bunch more fasting now, well, that's going to cause a bunch of people a bunch of problems and could alienate them from the church and thus from God. So I think that that what you think of the current level of fasting, which I acknowledge is pretty darn minimal, is something that people can have different opinions on.
Shalom. Thank you very much. That brings us exactly to the break. So we'll take a very quick break. Back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Catch up with the latest news from Washington, D.C., the Vatican, and the world on all of our EWTN news platforms, including EWTN News Nightly, the National Catholic Register, and the world over. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. When questions come from the internet, they also come with interesting names. I always enjoy trying to pronounce the names that people take for themselves. And sometimes I look at the name and I don't know. Is that the person's name that their mom and dad gave them, or is that the name they took? The next one comes from Raksuj 456.
I'm pretty sure their parents, I'm pretty sure their family name is not 456.
No, that's, yeah.
The rest of it, I don't know.
That's in the future. What people, you know how people ask, like, what was Jesus's last name? And you have to explain, well, they didn't really have last name. In the future, it'll be like, what was Jesus's last number? And they're like, no, in the old days, people used names. They didn't just go by numbers.
Yeah. It's not like Francis 6 and Logan 5.
Logan 5. Wait, is Francis 6 in that movie? I do remember Logan 5. Is it the same movie, or are we talking about something?
I think it's actually Logan 6 and Francis 5.
Oh, yeah.
We're referring to Logan's Run for people who may not know.
One of the most important movies of the 1970s.
And in the books, there was the character Mary Mary 2.
Really? Mm-hmm. Two Marys, number two. All right. Did the apostles, this is Raksuj 456's question. Did the apostles think the parousia was imminent? That is, did they expect it within their lifetime?
Well, we have evidence that they did. One place that kind of hints at this is in Acts chapter 1, where after he's been raised from the dead, Peter asks Jesus, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? In other words, make Israel an independent kingdom again. And Jesus says, it's not for you to know what the Father has determined. So he points him towards the work of evangelization and says, don't worry about that. Now, that kind of hints that that Peter and the other members of the 12 may have been expecting the end of the world in their own day. But you could debate that because it's not as clear as it could be. But there's at least one passage later in the New Testament that is by not a member of the 12, but one of the apostles, the apostle Paul, that indicates that he definitely expected, at least initially, that the second coming was going to happen during his lifetime. The letter is 1 Thessalonians, and 1 Thessalonians was written about the year AD 50. St. Paul had been traveling through Thessalonica and had made some converts there, but then there was a riot, and he had to skedaddle and get out of Dodge real fast. And so he went to Athens. And because he hadn't had a long time to stay in Thessalonica, he didn't get to instruct the converts as thoroughly as he had wanted to. And that's part of what he's doing in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, is he's trying to catch them up on some things that he didn't have a chance to fully instruct them about or that they didn't understand. And one of them was the end of the world and when it's going to happen and what signs are going to precede it. And also various members of the Thessalonian community were concerned because they had loved ones who had died. And they were thinking, well, you need to be alive when Jesus comes back if you're going to be part of his kingdom. This was a misunderstanding that they had. And so St. Paul corrects them and says, no, don't worry about the dead in Christ. They're going to be fine. What he says, this is 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 16 and 17. He says, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with the cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God. And the dead in Christ will rise first." So it's like, don't worry about them. They're going to get united with Jesus even before we do. Then, he says, "We who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we'll always be with the Lord." So both the dead Christians and the living Christians, we're all going to get caught up to be with Jesus. And in fact, the dead will rise first, and then we'll get caught up. So you don't got to worry about the dead. But notice what he says about who's going to get caught up. We who are alive, who are left. So he's putting himself in that group. He uses the plural pronoun, first person pronoun, we. So he's envisioning himself as still being alive when the second coming happens. And so this is, I think, conclusive evidence that at least as of AD 50, St. Paul thought that the second coming was going to happen during his life. That's what he's assuming to be the case. Now, later, he realized this would not be what would be happening. If you read his last epistle, his last letter, which is 2 Timothy, he wrote that end of AD 66 or beginning of AD 67, shortly before his own execution. And so this is like 16 or 17 years after 1 Thessalonians. And he knows at this point he's going to die. He talks to Timothy in 2 Timothy about how I've run the race, I've finished the course, there's now laid up for me that crown of righteousness that the Lord will give me on judgment day. And so he knows he's about to die. He says, I'm going to be poured out like a drink offering. So he later came to understand that the second coming would not happen in his lifetime. And it was revealed to John that even the second coming was going to be significantly delayed, because in the book of Revelation, before the final end, there is this period of 1,000 years in chapter 20, known as the millennium. Millennium is just Latin for 1,000 years. And since 1,000 is a stock number, it may not be literally 1,000 years, could be a lot longer than that. In fact, the subsequent course of history would indicate it is a lot longer than that, because according to what I view as the best interpretation of Revelation, we're living in the millennium right now, and it's been going on for more than 1,000 years. So it's just a stock number. It means a long period of time. But by the time the book of Revelation was written, which was basically the second half of AD 68, it had been revealed that there would be this really long period of time before the end of the world. So there was an initial belief that it would be happening very soon, but by the AD 60s, it was being revealed that no, there's going to be a much longer period of time, and the apostles are not going to be living to see it.
What a great question, Rock Suj. Thank you very much for that question. This one comes from Megan War. Is it possible angels are actually saints from a previous iteration of the universe?
Okay, so this is a question that starts with, is it possible? And anything that starts with, is it possible, my first pass interpretation is going to be, could God make this happen? And my second question is going to be, has God said he's not going to make this happen? Well, okay, so it could God have a cyclical, have made a cyclical universe so that our universe is not the first? Well, sure, he could do that. There's no logical contradiction there. It doesn't involve a, you know, a square circle or a four-sided triangle or a married bachelor. So there's no contradiction in the terms involved in the idea of there being a cyclical universe. And so God could have made a cyclical universe that had earlier iterations. Could God have preserved some creatures from that earlier universe into our universe, kind of like Galactus in Marvel Comics, because he started in the previous universe and then came through the Big Bang into our universe in Marvel Comics? Well, there's no logical contradiction there either. So God could have preserved creatures into our version of the universe that were from a previous version of the universe. Could those, since angels are created intellects, they don't have bodies, could God have preserved intellectual creatures from a previous universe into our universe? Well, there's no logical contradiction there. So I would say that today's angels, in terms of logical possibility, could be saints from a previous iteration of the universe. I can't eliminate that. Now, the second question is, like I said, has God said he's not going to do this? And no, God has not said that, not anywhere I know. It's not in the Bible. So I have to leave the possibility open that he could do this. But do I have any evidence that that's what angels are? And no, I don't. In the first place, I don't have any evidence that there was a previous iteration of the universe. So it could be, could well be, the Big Bang is the beginning of creation and there were no previous universes. Secondly, the standard assumption, and this is just an assumption, it's not a, it's not something that's been proven, but this either by theological means or non-theological means, but the standard assumption throughout Christian history is that the angels were created as part of our creation. If you look actually in some Second Temple literature, like the Book of Jubilees, it talks about when, on what day of the week of creation were the angels and other spirits created. But, you know, that's something that it's non-canonical, so it's not really proof or anything. But the standard assumption has been that the angels are part of our creation, and the biblical authors don't really envision there being other creations. So I would say I can't rule out this possibility, but I also have no evidence for it. And I would tend to default to the standard Christian assumption that angels are part of our cycle of creation. And if there are other cycles of creation behind us or in front of us or beside us, I'll leave that up to God.
Megan, thanks very much. You want to take this next question, Jimmy? Think we can get it?
Sure.
All right. This one comes from Holly. Does a baptized person who commits a mortal sin lose all grace given to them by God until confession? I know baptism leaves an indelible mark. To me, it seems that there's a difference in grace between a non-baptized person who commits adultery unapologetically and a baptized person who goes to church weekly and prays regularly but consistently struggles with mortal sins, say, of unchastity or drunkenness.
So Holly is... to answer Holly's question, basically, no, a person doesn't lose all grace given to them by God when they sin mortally and haven't yet been to confession. They do lose sanctifying grace, but that doesn't mean they lose other forms of grace. For example, they, over the course of the Christian life, may have built up good habits that incline them towards doing good things. And, you know, they don't lose those good habits just because they committed a mortal sin. They may have been much worse before they became a Christian and hadn't built up those good habits yet. Also, as she notes, baptism leaves an indelible mark on the soul, but more particularly, in addition to sanctifying grace, there's what's known as actual grace. Actual grace is what God gives us to help us do good things. And so, in fact, it's actual grace that prompts us to go to confession. So God's obviously still working in the soul of someone who has fallen into mortal sin and helping them repent and helping them go to confession and helping them do good things. So they don't lose all grace. In fact, there's a promise in Scripture. God says at one point to his children, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." So even if you fall into sin, God's not just going to abandon you. He's going to keep working with you. And thus, you don't lose all grace. You're still going to have actual grace that helps you get back into a state of sanctifying grace.
And that, Holly, is good news. Thanks very much for the question. Let me count them up. About a million more questions to come. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. All the questions are in from the internet. On this 4th of July, we'll take a very quick break and be right back with more Jimmy on Catholic Answers Live.